Hi, this is Dana Stevens, Slate's movie critic, here with a Slate spoiler special podcast on Iron Man 3, the latest installment in the superhero Marvel franchise. I'm joined here in the Slate studio by Forrest Wickman, a staff writer at Slate.
Hey, Dana.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for coming in to spoil. And we actually
have a third this time,
unusually. We have Nina Shen Rastogi. Hi, Nina.
Hi.
And you are a former Slatester.
Yes.
Sometimes Slate
always
contributor.
Always Slatester.
And always Slatester at heart.
Always forever.
And now you are the director of Figment. Can you tell us what Figment is?
Yeah.
You're the head of content at Figment.
Yes, right. I'm the head of content. Figment is a digital writing community for teens and young adults. So we have a user-generated library of about 500,000 stories, mostly by 13 to 19-year-olds. So listeners out there who fall between those ages or know people who do should send them over to figment.com.
Oh, that's great. So it's a place that you showcase writing and kind of talk about writing with other teenagers.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, whether if you're a writer looking for an audience, you come to Figment and post your stories. If you are somebody looking for great entertainment, you can come onto Figment and find a huge library of works by young people.
That sounds great. So, I'm glad it didn't exist when I was 13, though, because that stuff would still live on.
I know.
All right, so Iron Man 3, guys. I don't know where. Well, we usually start with sort of a vague yes or no. Obviously, you can qualify and be ambivalent as the spoiler goes on, but overall, would you say that you liked this movie?
I'm a definite yes, the more I think about it. So I think a lot of us have had this experience where I've pretty much completely forgotten the movie, and it's been 2 days since we saw it. So going through the plot synopsis may be hard, but I just liked it as a Shane Black movie, I guess, which I was talking to the producer of the Slate spoiler special before going to see this movie, to Chris Wade, and, I felt like a lot of these Marvel movies are really sort of constrained by how much all the demands put on them by Marvel, that you have to get this character from point A to point B by the end, and so on and so on. But there's definitely, so Shane Black's the writer and director, there's definitely a sense of his funny quirks in here, which I enjoy. He wrote Lethal Weapon, and he did this movie with Robert Downey Jr. called Kiss Kiss Bang Bang that I really like, and this feels almost like an unofficial sequel to that.
Hey, you're stealing my review from me. I was just writing about this movie's resemblance to Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, which is, the only other movie he's directed, although he is known for writing action movies really well.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And this has a very, very similar feeling. They're showcases for Robert Downey Jr.'s talent. Mm-hmm. They have these kind of snarky, self-aware voiceovers that double back on themselves. But wait, before we get into all of that.
And it takes place during Christmas, even though it comes out.
Yes, Shane Black is obsessed with Christmas, apparently.
Something
every single
like
one of his
8 movies.
And this movie doesn't really make a hell of a lot out of the Christmas decor. But anyway, okay, so, but Nina, I want to hear your overall reaction.
My overall reaction, I felt like the film had a real kind of crackle to it. I really liked a bunch of the performances. But overall, I thought the movie didn't really stick with me at all. I would have to say.
Yeah, I think what you were saying about the constraints, that every superhero action movie of this size is going to have, almost just as a global product, it's going to have those. It doesn't really ever quite supersede those constraints, I would say. It doesn't shake off those shackles completely, but it's Robert Downey Jr., so it wedges a lot of wit in there.
And also, the more I think about it, the less sense it makes, so I'm excited to go through that.
Let's talk a little bit about the story and some of the stuff that doesn't make sense. And let's get to the villains, too. I definitely want to get to the villains while we're talking plot, especially because there's this strange kind of nested villain structure, right? There's a villain kind of that leads to another villain. So, okay, none of us remember the movie, but together can we try to come up with some sort of story synopsis?
All right. Well, I guess, so at the very beginning, it's a New Year's Eve party in Bern, Switzerland, and it's 1999. Yeah.
Yep.
Tony Stark is in his old womanizing ways and is leaving a party with the beautiful and criminally underutilized in this movie, Rebecca Hall.
Great.
And who plays, she's some like mutant, she's not a mutant, but she does like mutant botany.
She's not a mutant, yes.
She's perfecting the DNA of plants.
Yeah, she's turning.
And accidentally exploding them.
Yes, she makes exploding plants, which you can imagine is
a safety hazard.
Yes. And so Tony and Rebecca Hall, whose name in the movie I can't even remember.
Maya.
Go off into their hotel room, and on their way in the elevator, they meet a very squirrely Guy Pearce.
Eagerly trying to peddle this piece of biotechnology, right, to get, I guess, Tony Stark to be a venture capitalist.
So one thing I was confused about, isn't he pitching the same technology that Maya's pitching? I don't really want to get into every one of these questions, but if you guys don't have the answer to that, I'm sure there's an answer to that basic of a question.
Yeah, I'm not sure how in bed together they're supposed to be at that point, yeah. or if they're more sort of like colleagues that vaguely know each other. My impression was that she comes to work for him later on.
Yeah, right. That was my impression as well.
But isn't the technology that Guy Pearce's character pitches the same thing?
The like brain
about
DNA. Essentially, but I think it was like in beta back then and he needed Maya to make it all come together or something. But so then once we get to the present day, one thing I wanted to say about that flashback is that it is an endearing way to begin because it incorporates the biography that we know of Robert Downey Jr. I mean, I think anytime you hear about Tony Stark's past, you're also talking about Robert Downey Jr.'s past. And I maintain that I still think a huge part of the charm of this character is just how sort of collectively proud everyone is of Robert Downey Jr. For pulling himself up basically out of, you know, the gutter to become this superhero.
Yeah,
and
my understanding, I'm not a you know huge Iron Man comics fan, but my understanding is that the one really like big Iron Man storyline has to do with Iron Man confronting Tony Stark confronting his alcoholism. So there was like always a kind of like nice marriage of that actor and that.
But
character.
That hasn't come in the movies at any point yet, right?
I mean,
there's some sort of there's a hint at addiction in this movie when he's kind of addicted to his tinkering, as he calls it. You know, he gets addicted to just waking up really early and going into his workshop and working on
dancing
crazy stuff.
Weirdly to Christmas music
and ignoring his girlfriend.
I never want to see that image again.
I loved it.
But so let's get so the, now we get back to the present day and the superhero plot. So Guy Pearce in the interim has become this suave biotech millionaire, I guess, who's still looking for venture capital. Is that why he goes back to Tony Stark again?
It seemed like maybe that was the cover, but really he just wanted to get at
infiltrate,
Pepper.
Right?
Yeah, infiltrate.
Yeah, I'm not totally sure. One important detail is that the first time he appears, he has like horrible, horrible teeth and he's sort of hobbling with a cane. Mm-hmm. And then the next time he appears, as you said, he's suave and he's like totally a stud, you know, physically as well, standing upright.
Right. Presumably the extremists.
Exactly.
Is it a technology? Is it a virus? I don't know what the thing is.
But a biotechnology?
Possibly.
It's very poorly explained, which I think is a flaw in the movie. The science doesn't have to make sense. It can be the cheesiest pseudoscience. Yeah. We want it to be the cheesiest pseudoscience, but we want to have one expository scene where somebody's like pointing at vectors and explaining what happened to these people, right? Because when he administers this biotech, whatever it is to them, they essentially turn into like walking pillars of
lava.
Flame.
Yeah. But I think, and I know we maybe want to talk about villains after, but I think the sort of problem with the plot structure is very similar to the sort of problems I had with
This is villains. This is our discussion of villains. So take it away. Let's get into the second and I think more interesting and more complicated villain.
Right. So so the villain at the top of the film ostensibly is this character called the Mandarin, who has some kind of crazy TV hacking powers and he can just like show up on broadcasts. And he's played by the always marvelous Ben Kingsley. And he kind of has this like Bin Laden beard and this sort of samurai topknot. And, you know, when he shows up on people's screens, he's got these like dragon statues by him. He's wearing these long robes.
So he's this mix of Orientalisms, right? Where you can't figure out what's going where. And his accent, I think deliberately, is a complete mess.
Like, what is that?
It's kind of flat Midwestern by way
of something. It's his accent from Sneakers, which is notoriously puzzling, as noted at length in Slate.
I see. That's
But I don't think it's an accident, because when he shifts accents, as we'll get to in a minute, I mean, it's too precisely dead on for the first accent to have been just an amalgam of misses, you know. I
right,
think it was
right. It was, I mean, you know, and in the pre-release, you know, interviews that he had given and the producers had given, they, you know, they talk about the fact that the Mandarin is a character who sort of deliberately blurs ethnic lines, and he's about, you know, scrambling your cultural signals and representing sort of everything America is afraid of, you know. So this is the character of the Mandarin at the beginning. And the history of the Mandarin, is sort of in the comics, he's Tony Stark's longest running foe. You know, he's kind of the main villain because he's just the longest running. But he begins, you know, in the Iron Man canon in the early 60s, from the earliest, as the sort of Fu Manchu kind of descendant.
Yellow Peril,
yeah. You know, in the Fu Manchu style, he is this brilliant wily Oriental who also happens to be like a karate master. And then there's like a whole plot where he discovers like alien technology and dragons and whatnot. But in this film, you know, there had been a lot of talk before the movie was released about the fact that you have Ben Kingsley, who is a half South Asian, half British actor, playing this character who is sort of historically always half, you know, Han Chinese and half British. So anyway, so this is the whole backstory. Everybody wondering like what kind of cultural mess the Mandarin is going to be. And in the film, about like two-thirds of the way through, Iron Man, you know, Tony Stark goes to Miami, where he has somehow discovered that...
It's definitely in Florida. Yeah, it's around Miami.
The Mandarin is. And the Mandarin is revealed to be this, you know, sort of drunken British...
Trevor Slattery,
actor who has been hired to play the Mandarin. And all along, the real villain is the newly gorgeous Adrian. I don't even know what's his name? What's Guy Pearce's name?
Killian is his last name, which is a good supervillain.
And his first name is something like Eldritch, but it's not.
Aldrich Killian, yes. So all along, the crazy ethnic Oriental other
was the puppet
villain,
of this mastermind.
Yeah.
Right. So. Deliberately constructed that way by Killian.
Right.
The scene is actually very funny where Ben Kingsley switches over to being Trevor Slattery and suddenly has a Cockney accent and is a drunk and a drug
addict.
So
funny.
Cracking Budweiser's.
Just such good timing. That Ben Kingsley.
And very good dialogue, actually, between them in that scene, too. But actually, I think the movie never reaches that height again, and certainly that character never does. He essentially drops out of the movie. So at once, I thought the exposure of, you know, that weirdly ethnic performance you're talking about as a performance and as complete artifice was great and interesting and brought up something that could have been kind of awesome, like a whole chapter of the movie about superhero self-construction, you know, and how did Aldrich Killian decide on all these signifiers and pull it together and hire the actor. And instead, essentially, that character disappears from the movie until we see him, like, being taken into custody at the end or something.
Right.
Like
and he's
that.
All excited because of the flashbulbs. But, I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that the Mandarin says when we still think that he's, like, the villain is, you know, asks us to consider the fortune cookie, which, you know, like, looks Chinese and sounds Chinese but is actually American, which is why it's hollow and meaningless. And it's like you just built your own critique of this character and the mythology into your movie. You know, like, all of it feels... empty in the fact that the plot doesn't hold together in any way that makes a coherent mythology. The villains don't feel like, I don't know, like villains with any kind of substance to them.
But don't you still, I agree with all that, but don't you guys still forgive this movie a lot because of the genre that it exists in is just so limiting? I mean, we could wish that this kind of movie didn't exist anymore, that we were done with the epic of superheroes and that they disappeared like dinosaurs. But given that they do exist, I mean, as you said at the beginning, this movie does crackle. It has a lot of life for this kind of movie.
Yeah, just as, you know, a twist for me sitting there while munching my popcorn, though I wasn't, it was great. It got huge laughs. And it was one of the smarter twists I've seen in any of these movies and one of the most legitimately surprising ones. There were some, you know, things that could tip you off, like that accent early on, and I was beginning to get suspicious, but still, it was delightful to me when it happened. But I understand
when I talk
where
about forgiving
from.
It, though, it's not even so much the twist. I'm talking in a larger sense just about the whole, you know, the top-heavy actionness of the whole movie. You know, the fact that the last 20 minutes is essentially kind of indistinguishable from any other superhero action movie. All that stuff is something
punchings.
Of a given. But I still was surprised the extent to which some sort of story character, you know, any sort of... you know, humor was able to be wedged in there, mainly in the scenes between Gwyneth Paltrow and Robert Downey Jr.
Although one disappointment I had getting back to who turns out to be the main villain is Guy Pearce. I love Guy Pearce. I always want to see more of him. He's been playing a lot of villains lately, almost exclusively villains now. And he's really fun in maybe a sort of questionable role in Lawless, for example. But in this, I didn't really know what to take away from his character. I had no idea what motivated him. He gives a speech about how he's, you know, engineering this villain. At the same time, he's creating the technology to fight them. So he's creating supply and demand, an endless cycle that will get him endlessly rich. But that's, you know, it seems like a lot to throw the whole world into like world war to make a bunch of money.
Yeah, it's like almost like trying to be like a comment on this sort of, you know, gleeful capitalist that like Tony Stark is like this like control, but like it's
he needed some kind of ideological motivation, however absurd, in order to reach, you know, the heights of supervillaindom. He has, you know, he has to have mean something larger than just I want power and money for the sake of power,
or just that, you know, I used to be like a nerd with bad hair and bad skin and bad teeth, and therefore I want to wreak havoc on beautiful people and the world. But even that didn't really
Yeah, I would have found
out.
That a lot more compelling just on like a personal level watching right. it as a piece of drama. But and it felt like all the pieces were there for that, but they didn't really
right.
drive it home.
Right.
Like I could piece it together myself watching it, but it didn't click
yeah.
with me at the time.
Right. But and that to me feels like a kind of like a classic superhero villain motivation. Like I feel like that would have been really legible. It would have made sense. But they just either didn't feel like they had to because the twist was enough to sort of satisfy people that
yeah, everything unraveled after the twist, just story-wise. In the villain yeah. plot, both the villain plots became almost completely negligible, and mm-hmm. you were really sort of in it for the banter, the screwball scenes.
Mm-hmm.
And then, oddly enough, this sounds so horrible on paper, but the relationship between Robert Downey Jr. and that kid, when they throw in the kid that he meets on the yeah. trip to Tennessee, and he has this kind of dry bantering, very sort of spoofing of a sentimental, mm-hmm. you know, father-son relationship with this kid, that was a great addition as well.
Yeah, yeah, I love that. I mean, you say it's like that, it's sort of spoofing that. And mostly it ends up just being Robert Downey Jr. being a dick to this kid.
Right.
I found that sort of
funny.
Refreshing. I felt like a lot of the movie just felt like sort of Shane Black was sitting in the chair next to me making fun of the movie as it went along. Mm-hmm. And it was enjoyable as that, but then it would just revert back to the sort of bloated action sequences that didn't really drive home. But
yeah.
I liked that whole diversion to Tennessee.
Yeah.
Like,
I'm still not
the kid.
I don't entirely remember who that kid was or...
I think he's just a random – Iron Man just happen to like crash near his yard?
Yeah.
And he was enough of a mechanics nerd that he had a workshop, right? That,
right.
That
right.
the Iron Man could use to repair his Iron Man
suit. And that's another element too, I guess. It's like Iron Man's suit is broken down and Iron Man is sort of rebuilding himself and spending time mm-hmm. sort of dealing with his trauma from New York, another plot line that I don't really think went anywhere.
Yeah.
I don't know how he resolved his trauma from New York. But anyway, that kid is a lot like the young Tony Stark is driven home by the fact that he's building stuff a lot mm-hmm. and the fact that he has an absent father, and so Tony Stark is always bashing on this. How he says something about how the absent father is just a dick or something, and
yeah.
like, get over it.
Yeah, so
then,
said,
know,
don't be a pussy about it.
Don't be a pussy, right?
And there's not really any redemption or any moment where he apologizes for mistreating the kid. He just kind of continues to beat him about the head and face.
Yeah, yeah, which I very much enjoyed.
Okay, maybe because we're all somewhat bored by the action in this movie, we haven't really spoiled any of the action. So if someone's sitting around saying, I want to understand about that awesome moment in the trailer when I saw X, Y, or Z, we haven't addressed any of those moments. Do you guys want to take any big, spectacular action scenes and say anything about them, good or bad?
So I think this action scene is neither big nor spectacular, but the action sequence that really sets things going is this bombing at the Mann's Chinese Theater in California, and that's where we meet, I guess, like the main sort of henchmen, although they're hench people. There's henchmen and henchwomen in this movie who are these people using that plant DNA biotechnology who... are able to turn themselves into fire people, I guess. They look like T-1000 from Terminator 2. And then, either intentionally or not, they occasionally explode. And then either reform themselves or don't reform themselves. And the mechanics of this were a constant source of frustration for me because...
All right, you have no idea what the laws of the fire people
yeah.
are. How are
yeah.
they killed? How are they made? Do they have minds or are they just mindless zombies?
They used to be disabled?
I think, yeah, they were soldiers who were disabled and so signed up for some sort of healing because they were desperate to get their legs back from Iraq or whatever. And yeah, sometimes it works out and they survive and sometimes they explode. And sometimes they get shot in the chest and immediately die, and sometimes, as we see with Gwyneth Paltrow in the end, they fall into a giant ball of flames from 300 feet and survive.
Yeah.
And I have no idea what the difference here. Like, there's no silver bullet or stake to the heart that is the clear way that, and maybe it's explained in the comics. Like, that might be what they're relying on, but I think that's an annoying and lazy device.
Clearly, all of Gwyneth Paltrow's kale smoothies that allowed her to, allowed her body to
right.
absorb that.
Secret power.
Yeah. I also thought that Mann's Chinese Theater scene, like, because I went into this movie looking to see if there was something to write about the villain. And so that scene, I was like, oh, my God, okay, Asian signifiers in America, there's going to be something here. And there wasn't.
Yeah, they didn't really do anything.
Yeah, it's just a vaguely famous place to blow up.
Yeah, that has, like, Asian, you know, and so they could talk about fortune cookies and Mann's Chinese Theater. Like, there was, at some point, the Mandarin, like, does try to, like, compare Mann's Chinese Theater to a fortune cookie, which is, like, an American simulacrum of something that means something. I mean, you lost me.
Nor did they do anything with those, like, metal arrowheads that they have in the suitcase. Do you remember this at the time?
I guess
it's sort of a MacGuffin, and presumably it will pay off in, like, The Avengers 2 or something. But
Iron
in the
Man
meantime,
7.
I have no idea what
Wow, you guys watch this
are.
At a whole different level than me. I have no memory of metal arrowheads in the suitcase. But I wanted to shout out to the best action scene in the movie, which is this skydiving, very simple skydiving stunt where essentially Air Force One explodes. A bunch of people fall out of it. There's a pretty terrifying scene of people just being sucked out of a hole in an airplane into the sky, and you sort of think, well, high body count. Those people are done for. But no, Iron Man ends up skydiving down and making this human chain because Jarvis, his supercomputer voiced by Paul Bettany, is coming in his ears to tell him you can only hold 4 of these 13 people that have fallen out of the plane. And so he ends up using teamwork to make this human chain. It's completely absurd. I would love a physicist to talk about the 15 reasons that it's impossible.
It's definitely an explainer topic.
Could be. Although I'm working on one about the infamous three-point landing, which is the landing that Iron Man always does. Do you know this?
No.
Yeah, where you basically, anytime a superhero lands in movies these days, they land with one knee down, one leg off to the side, one fist down, and one like hand up.
I can picture that perfectly, yeah.
Three-point, just like an airplane or something. So I'm looking into whether it's actually a good way to I'm asking a bunch of kinesiologists.
It depends. Are your knees made of plutonium is the first question.
Right, exactly. Yeah. If you're Iron Man, you can presumably get that.
You can presumably land any way you want. I guess that's the last big, special effect scene that people saw in the trailer was Tony Stark's house being blown up. Was that in the trailer?
That was in the trailer. And right, it happens very early. Basically, Tony Stark gets really pissed, and so he broadcasts his address on live TV or something.
And says, come get me, Mandarin.
Yeah.
But, I don't understand. Tony Stark's house is so big. How do people not already know where it is? Why did he have to go on television?
It is not the Batcave.
It's not the Batcave.
And it's so iconic and visible, right? In its own universe, it's constantly being shown on television, like Stark Industries, and you see that modern house on the cliff.
Yeah. Nor does Tony prepare that well for this inevitable attack from his arch nemesis. I guess he sets some things up, but mostly he just lets them in.
Yeah.
You would think, I would sort of like as a character trait if he were more upset that his lair had been destroyed, because obviously the man has house pride, right? I mean, we see so many scenes of him, working on his place, putting cool new things in his place.
Buying giant bunnies for his live-in lover.
And yet neither of them seem to really mourn their incredibly cool residence when it's blown to bits.
Yeah. Maybe Iron Man 4 will be like the two of them like living in a yurt somewhere, getting back to the land.
So, one quick gripe from there is that all of the suspense from that whole house attack sequence is just manufactured by the fact that Tony's suit, for some reason, isn't charged yet. So you're just he can't fly. And so you're waiting for him to fly, and you're waiting for him to fly, and he's fighting, and you're waiting for him to fly. And then all of a sudden, of course, at the last minute, he's down at the bottom of the ocean. And you've seen this in the trailer. It's like, how does Tony, will he get out of this one? Tune in next week. And then it's just like, your suit is now recharged. And then he flies away. And it's cheap.
It's like superhero anxiety for the iPhone age.
Yeah. Like the big anxiety is, will the progress bar make it until the end? That's what you're looking at. All right, you guys. Well, please come in very soon again, and let's do a three-way spoiler. This was really fun.
We'd love to, yeah.
Yeah, thanks.
Our producer is Chris Wade. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Andy Bowers. For Slate.com, I'm Dana Stevens.
Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team, led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.